Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, an original production from KJZZ. Every weekday, we bring you the latest news and culture from across the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, a look at the challenging year in Arizona housing.
And we remember a former director of the ASU Art Museum.
But first, with the start of the new year, the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors will have a new chair. And 2026 will begin with the board and County Recorder Justin Heap involved in a lawsuit over the roles each has in elections. A judge last month allowed the county to start an audit of its election system over Heap's objection, but other disagreements are still there. Tom Galvin has served as chair of the Board of Supervisors for the last year. As he gets ready to pass the gavel, he came by the studio earlier this week to talk about the past 12 months and the future. And we started with the controversy over elections between the supervisors and county recorder and where that stands at the moment.
Well, it depends on the situation, right? So in terms of planning and being proactive about preparing for elections, we're working together. The Board of Supervisors and the county recorder, our election duties are bifurcated. So we canvass the elections, but we also run operations on election day. But the recorder has important election responsibilities, which include sending out mail-in ballots and then receiving them. But at the same time, there is a lawsuit going on that is basically kind of hanging over our heads. But we're working with the recorder on a professional basis.
Do you get the feeling that lawsuit will be resolved by the time you start holding elections in 2026?
Well, I certainly hope so. In fact, the recorder filed for a temporary restraining order against the Board of Supervisors a few weeks ago. And as I said then, and I say it repeatedly, the Board of Supervisors, we don't start fights, but we finish them. And so I was confident we would win that, and we did win that. I also feel really good about our stance and our arguments in the current lawsuit that is pending. However, we have very important elections coming up. We have jurisdictional elections in the springtime, and then obviously we have the primary election in the summer, and then we have the general election in the fall, which features statewide races. The Board of Supervisors is taking all of that in a very responsible and prudent fashion, and we're going to make sure that we're completely prepared for those elections.
Let me ask you about another issue that I know you've been working on over the past year, and that is the issue of housing and affordable housing. And you know, we've gotten a lot of news releases from the county supervisors about new apartment complexes, new housing units opening up over the past year. I'm curious how much of a dent you think specifically the county can put into this region's housing shortage.
I think we can put a significant dent in terms of making progress. All of us in the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors, we really care about this issue about housing affordability. As Maricopa County keeps growing, I have seen constituents and I have talked, especially with young families, people who just have kids, it's hard for them to find a house to buy, much less a house of their dreams. The other thing is that we sense a real frustration at the state level that the governor and the legislature really haven't addressed this issue head on. They've been nibbling at the edges. But Maricopa County, we're the fourth largest county in the country, and the five of us serve in an executive role. And so what we have done in an executive fashion is take charge and lead on this issue. No one told us to do this. And what we have done is work on issues that people believe are really important in housing affordability and making sure that there's enough supply in the market to help this market grow is important.
Do you think this ideally would be an area that maybe you and your colleagues on the board would not have to deal with? You mentioned the governor and legislature haven't really done a ton in this area. Would you prefer that this all come from the states or maybe even the cities?
I do, because this is a statewide issue. But at the same time, Maricopa County, we can't just sit back and watch others. What we have done is take the lead on a wide variety of issues, not just housing affordability, but in terms of budgeting, we have a balanced budget. In terms of elections, as you just seen, we have done a lot in terms of election integrity, but other major issues, including water, transportation, and now, of course, housing.
Let me ask you about another sort of land use issue that you just dealt with fairly recently in terms of zoning, specifically related to data centers. And this has been such a big issue, not just here in the Valley, but and around the state, but around the country as well. What did you hear from your constituents about what they are okay with and maybe what they are not okay with as it relates to those particular facilities?
For data centers, you have to look at it from what's reasonable and what's appropriate for the land use designation. There was a lot of chatter about a project that got denied out in the East Valley last week. But in Maricopa County, we do a very serious job of taking a look at where these data centers should be placed. It doesn't mean that they're all great. It doesn't mean they're all bad. You have to take them on a case-by-case basis. But President Trump and Democrats in Congress have all agreed that this is a national security issue in terms of planning ahead for the economy of the future. How are we going to address AI? How are we going to address energy needs? How are we going to address the threats from China and the challenge from China militarily and economically, right? And so at Maricopa County Board of Supervisors, we balance all of those interests and we approve projects where we believe they should be placed in a reasonable fashion.
I wonder if you and your colleagues on the board are maybe in a unique position because the rules apply to unincorporated land, a county land, which not always, but oftentimes are sort of not in huge population centers. Does that maybe give you more of an interesting place to be looking at facilities like data centers that a lot of residents have said they don't necessarily want to live that close to?
Kind of, but not really, because you still have to answer a lot of questions that you would answer in any incorporated city. What are the infrastructure issues at play here? What about water? What about energy needs? You have to talk to the utilities. So at the county board, it's not like we have it easy because we're designated unincorporated areas. We still have to take a hard look at these things. Also, jobs. This is about jobs. You can't just stick out a building out in the middle of nowhere because you want people to drive to those jobs or to have transportation to those jobs. So I believe that we're still wrestling with all the same questions that cities do as well. I think we just do a really good job of heading off projects that are really not good for the proposed location, and we do a really good job of placing them where they should be.
Before I let you go, I want to ask you about an issue that I know is near and dear to your heart. You started earlier this year a committee to try to bring an NHL team back to the Valley. Where are you in that effort, and like, how optimistic would you say that you are that the Valley will have another hockey team here?
Well, I'm going to take the second question first. I'm very optimistic that eventually we'll have an NHL team return back to the Valley. But it's in terms of finding an owner and finding the appropriate location. This fall, I named Andrea Doan, who's known as the wife of Shane Doan and the mother of Josh Doan, but she's a well-known name within hockey circles herself, as the chair of this public advisory committee. This is a citizens-led committee to bring pro hockey back to the Valley. We're working hard at this. This is a years-long process, and what I have said repeatedly is, unlike previous ownership groups with the Coyotes, we're not going to do it the wrong way. We're going to do it the right way, which means we're not going to overpromise and we're not going to underdeliver.
It seems like in the past, and you and I have talked about this, the ownership group and the arena, right, the building, are sort of the two big stumbling blocks. Have you made any appreciable progress on either of those?
Absolutely on both. Obviously, when this news came out in January that I was forming this committee, I heard from a lot of folks. And my job and the committee's task is to separate the pretenders from the contenders. Another thing is to look at locations and make sure what is viable. In the private sector, I work as a land use attorney, so I understand these issues intimately. And what we saw in previous iterations was that previous Coyote ownership groups did a really bad job of finding location or selling the court in the court of public opinion on why these locations would be good or not. We got to do this from the ground up approach. We're also working with local youth advocacy groups. We're working with Lindsay Fry, who's an Olympian from the East Valley, and we're going to work together as a team, quote unquote, to make sure as a community we're going to bring this team back the right way.
What have you heard so far from the NHL about their interest in expanding back to Arizona?
It's no secret that the NHL has always been interested and happy with the Valley, but they understood that the previous ownership groups just did not do a good job of finding location, a permanent location for the team. I have had meetings with the NHL Commissioner Gary Bettman, and I have told them that I've seen this as a reputational issue for the Valley because we should not be losing teams. We should be gaining teams. And also, I see this as an economic development issue. When the Coyotes left, a lot of businesses were impacted on a secondary and tertiary level. And so he understands my commitment to bringing a hockey team, not just for the hockey and the sports aspect, but for the business and the economic development aspect. And he's fully supportive of that. But it's on us as a community to show the NHL not that we're entitled to a team, but that we're going to earn a team.
Okay, we'll have to leave it there. That is the outgoing chairman of the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors, Tom Galvin. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you. Happy holidays.
Turning Point USA's annual America Fest convention kicks off tonight in downtown Phoenix. Among other things, the conservative political group's gathering will feature speeches from the right's most prominent and controversial figures, including Tucker Carlson, Vice President J.D. Vance, and Turning Point CEO Erica Kirk. Erica is the widow of Turning Point co-founder Charlie Kirk, who was murdered earlier this year and was largely responsible for the group's intense popularity among young conservatives. America Fest will take place at the Phoenix Convention Center. And just down the road at Marley's Sports Grill, a left-wing group will attempt to do some counter-programming. The group is called National Ground Game, and they're calling their event something we can't say on the radio. Let's just say it rhymes with Unstuck America. On Saturday night at Marley's, they'll have popular lefty influencers doing live events designed to offer an alternative to America Fest. The event is part of a broader strategy to become, as National Ground Game founder Z. Cohen Sanchez calls it, the turning point of the left. Our co-host Sam Dingman spoke with Cohen Sanchez about how she plans to engage the young voters turning point has been so effective at recruiting.
What we found is that when we do have these conversations with kids from Turning Point, we're able to really get through to them because we are not the stuffy Democrats that tone police people. They see us as kind of like one of them.
So, you know, let's say I'm a 18, 19-year-old Turning Point-affiliated college student. I'm walking into America Fest. I've got my suit and tie on. I'm here and I'm really sad about Charlie Kirk's death. And I'm here to find out how Turning Point plans to, you know, continue advancing the worldview that I've signed on with. And somebody from the UNF America Tour comes up to me. What's the strategy there? Like, how would you approach that conversation?
So Charlie was a really interesting figure in this movement because while he was somebody obviously that supported Trump, right, and that has, you know, done more groundwork arguably than anybody for Donald Trump, shifting the youth vote 9 points to the right, he also, I think, sort of had this like solo personality that people were attracted to. So we don't really find a lot of these kids to be going there because they necessarily support Republican candidates. The main reason that we get from them in terms of why they're attending Turning Point events is because their parents, quote unquote, want them to network.
But so how do you engage that person? What do you look for as a source of connection or an entryway to that conversation?
So if they tell us that they do support Donald Trump, then we will usually start to ask them why that is. And typically what we find is that they usually don't have a lot of answer to that. That's where we really start to sort of break apart the worldview a little bit. And this is obviously not something that happens in one conversation or overnight, but it's more so that we're looking to develop a longer term relationship with them. And that's what we found with a lot of the Turning Point kids is that we will go to these events and we'll start out those conversations. And sometimes they're not even about politics. I mean, sometimes it's just about like what their ambitions are and all of those things. And then, you know, they come to our event and they say, oh, they see that, you know, we're at a bar. We're not in like a stuffy, crappy venue where we have, you know, 18 hours of back-to-back speeches.
So let me ask you, though, Z, what about issues? Because one of the things that makes Turning Point very effective is that they seem to me to have this kind of purity culture almost from an issue standpoint. You're either all in on things like anti-trans policy, strong borders, anti-woke cultural crusading in academia, or you're not. And one of the things that Turning Point has been very effective at is that if you step outside of their orthodoxy, they kind of come after you. Where does National Ground Game stand issue-wise?
The people that we're looking for, not just MAGA people that are coming over, we're also looking for the people that are apathetic, right? Like half of this country doesn't vote at all. And what we're finding is that it is very clear that 2026 is the year of affordability.
But I have to ask you, Z, I mean, Turning Point is so laser focused on college students and increasingly people in high school. Do you think affordability is what those potentially flippable voters care about? Because I have to say, being at America Fest last year, there was so much very forceful messaging about the supposed attack on masculinity, about this idea of America having become weak and too feelings driven. These were not really economic issues that they were focusing on.
Yeah, well, and I think a lot has changed since last year, right?
Sure.
I think that Last year, I mean, definitely. And of course, we are going to be faced with these same issues again, right? Like the trans issue. We've started to see this with Gavin Newsom, with Pete Buttigieg, with a lot of these larger politicians that are pushing back against this and being like, you know what? I think that we should have a more nuanced conversation about this. Like, you know, it's not super cut and dry. We don't think like all trans people should be in sports, for example. But also what is even more important than the central message of affordability and trying to stay away from these more cultural issues like the trans issue and things like that, what I call distraction issues, we're really trying to steer away from this like academic type of talk is like what I call it. I think that there are some issues that we are simply like not going to win on and I think need to be like primarily ignored.
But when it comes to something like trans issues, are you concerned that by not taking a stand, you are by default taking the administration's stand, which is actively anti-trans?
No, I think that it really comes down to, and, you know, very much what like Gavin Newsom and Pete Buttigieg's position is that we need to have a more nuanced conversation about what that looks like.
I hear that, Z, but you also did just say that nuanced academic conversations are the kind of thing that you're trying to avoid.
And that's why we shouldn't talk. In my opinion, we shouldn't talk about it at all.
Let me ask you a different question. A very significant thing that is part of Turning Point's effectiveness, I would argue, has been their ability to leverage faith. Charlie Kirk amassed a lot of his power by going to evangelical church services and giving what were essentially politically charged sermons. And I think that is a big part of what draws some young people to Turning Point is it feels like you're joining a movement. It feels like a way of life.
Again, I think that National Ground Game, what we're going to be more focused on is expanding the vote beyond the people that are currently voting. So what we're trying to do is expand to that other 50% of the country that is simply not voting at all.
So if I'm hearing you right, the hope is that the thing that will kind of draw those people out is this idea of affordability.
We think that that's going to be a central issue, yeah.
So I guess the other question here, Z, is, I mean, as you alluded to, Charlie Kirk was a uniquely charismatic figure, and that was a big part of how Turning Point was able to establish itself. Do you feel like your side here has a Charlie Kirk, needs a Charlie Kirk?
I don't think we need one. Because there isn't one on the right.
Do you feel that there is the need for some similarly magnetic presence to kind of draw those MAGA folks who may be disillusioned with their time on the right? What is the reason you see for them to explore the kinds of things that National Ground Game stands for?
So I think that it's going to really depend, honestly, on how affected they are by this Trump administration. I mean, obviously, AmFest is like the busiest it's ever been, right? They've sold like 15,000 tickets. I think part of that is obviously the shock of Charlie Kirk's murder. But eventually that will die off. And then the question really becomes, what next?
What next, indeed? Well, I have been speaking with Z. Cohen Sanchez, Executive Director of National Ground Game. Z, thank you very much for this conversation.
Thank you for having me.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, we continue our series Eating Christmas, and all our next reader wants this holiday season is a salad without onions.
As the end of the year nears, we're taking some time here on the show to talk about some of the biggest issues facing our state, what's happened in those arenas in the last year, and what's next for them in the new one. Today, let's zoom in on housing. From affordable housing to backyard casitas to barriers to home building, housing is never far from the headlines in Arizona. And now it's getting even more interesting as we're seeing the valley's seemingly unending population growth predicted to slow. Will home builders be able to catch up in 2026, and where will they build? For that and much more, I'm joined by Tom Simplot, former Phoenix City Council member and former director of the Arizona Department of Housing, as well as community advocate David Crummy, who sits on the board of the Arizona Research Center for Housing and Economic Solutions, or ARCHES. He has been deeply involved in the effort to build up downtown Mesa. And the big story in housing, at least from my point of view, covering it for many years, has really been affordability, supply and demand. We don't have enough housing. That's driven prices way up, priced a lot of people out of housing. It seems as though we might be coming to a turning point in this, though. And I want to start with you here, Tom. Are you seeing home building getting closer to meeting that demand? Where are we on that front?
I think it depends on what part of the valley that we're talking about. If we're talking about the high growth areas where we see the Taiwanese semiconductor plant going in, or plants going in, if we see the high growth areas, that's where you see a lot of housing. And of course, we have to remember Phoenix is always built to the edges, right? And we're going to continue to see that. Maybe where there's been a slowdown are the one-offs, the smaller developments, the developments within the core. And when I say the core, I mean Phoenix and the exurbs. Mm. So maybe that's going to slow down. But as we saw in the news today, brand new development, 1,900 acres planned for out in Goodyear. These are not going to stop anytime soon, especially when you consider home builders have to look so far out into the horizon in order to anticipate that demand in a few years.
Yeah. So let me turn to you then, David, because a lot of the work that you have done has been looking at trying to do the opposite, right? Like building up instead of out, thinking about walkability and, you know, how we can create urban density in this very driving focused city. Where are you seeing things? Like, is this kind of an unchanged narrative? Like Tom is saying, like, we are still pushing out to the limits.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's the big question, right, is that we've seen such huge increases in both housing prices for purchase and to rent. You know, I looked at the most recent Arches report and we're at 91% increase in home values since 2010.
91%,
and,
wow.
And 36% in rent. And we have seen over the last year sort of a pause in the increase, but we're not seeing a decrease. And where the stress has come from is people who are just everyday, you know, our core workforce not being able to afford housing or not being able to generate a new household so they can move out and start their families or their life out without roommates, without parents, without other support. And that portion has not shifted as much. We are just not building enough affordable and workforce housing at all to be able to make that shift, especially where people want to live, to give them choice in housing and accessibility to jobs and other services.
So still building to the edges. Tom, are we ever going to see prices go down? Is that a thing that happens?
It does happen. And the most recent one, of course, was 2008 with the crash. Yeah. Before that, we had the savings and loan debacle in the 1990s. We have these cataclysmic events that force the market to adjust. And I would suggest that the argument is just the reverse happened with COVID and the pandemic. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, it shifted the marketplace throughout the country. And now we realize just how far behind we had fallen since the surge in housing and leading up to the 2008 crash.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So we're also seeing this kind of long time narrative about Phoenix shift right now, which I think is fascinating on a lot of fronts, but housing is certainly one of them. Like, I think for as long as I can remember in the Valley, we've talked about this massive booming growth. Like, we are this fastest growing metropolis in the country. And it seems as if that growth is slowing. Tom, do you think that gives developers a chance to catch up in terms of home building?
I sure hope so. Having worked for the Home Builders Association many, many decades ago, I remember them very vividly saying that every so often it's nice to take a breath to be able to catch up and catch up in a variety of ways. Catching up with regard to finding the parcels and the land in which to build further out, catching up with regard to finding the labor supply in order to build what is under construction today. And of course, we know we're facing that shortage right now. So I would say if it is slowing to a discernible level in the metropolitan area, I would say perhaps it's just taking a breath or a slight pause or plateau before we then move forward again.
What do you think that could do, David, to affordability? Like, could those people who you're talking about who can't get into homes basically get a chance to get in if at least the market stabilizes?
I think that it makes it easier for individuals and families to be able to find a place that they can feel like the rent's not going to go up to $300 a month in the next year when they re-sign a lease. That might provide a little bit of breath, of room. But we have had such a backlog in housing development that my concern is that also with the reduction in rent, but the increase in construction costs, is that developers are not going to be building because they can't get rents that are going to be able to give them a return, except at the high end of the market. So if developers can't make at least a little bit of a profit to be able to make it make sense to invest millions and millions of dollars in our community 5 years out, 2 years out, are they going to be building at the rate that we need when rents aren't increasing? Because construction costs have gone up so much over the last, honestly, decade.
Yeah. Tom, isn't that where government's supposed to come in?
Well, yeah, right. And let's first define affordable housing. There is a development tool called low-income housing tax credits, which has been around since 1986 at the federal level. Arizona briefly had a state low-income housing tax credit. It lasted for 5 years. It happened to be in existence when I was at the department. It is now gone, and the legislature refused to extend it or to expand it. So that tool in the tool chest is gone. We're looking at more strict limits on low-income housing tax credits from the federal level. We are looking at a lot of restrictions on, quote, affordable housing. And of course, as David said, it's so imperative we have that in the spectrum of housing needs. It's imperative. But without these incentives from either the federal, state, or local governments, developers are really going to be hard-pressed to be able to make that pencil out.
All right, we'll leave it there for now. That's former Arizona Housing Director Tom Simplot and community advocate David Crummy. When we come back, we'll talk more about that and how we can support an aging community in terms of housing going forward. That's all after the break. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody.
And now let's return to our conversation on the year in housing in 2025 with community advocate David Crummy. He sits on the board of the Arizona Research Center for Housing and Economic Solutions, and Tom Simplot, former Arizona Housing Director. And before the break, we were talking about cuts to tax credits for housing developers to build affordable housing and how hard it could be to build affordable housing going forward. And what do you think about that, David? Like, what does that do to the fabric of our communities?
Part of it is just that we need to invest in our own communities. For so long, we have just used federal dollars, or mostly used federal dollars, to support our communities, that we need to look at it from a state and local level. How are we going to invest to make sure that our communities can last for the long term? If we're looking holistically at our community, at about healthcare, how are we building our community and how are we building our economy? If we can't support people who are working at the base level of our jobs, how do we support the higher income jobs that we know everyone wants to grow into?
David makes a really good point. I mean, that's the whole point of the spectrum of housing needs.
Right.
We need every single level, and we need more at every one of those levels. It's kind of a waterfall effect, quite frankly. If we don't have an open market, if we don't figure out how to restructure the development process at our cities and towns so the neighbors don't control and kill new developments, then we're not going to get out of this problem, and especially in the affordable housing mix. And by the way, just forever, decades in Phoenix, once people move into a subdivision or any neighborhood, they don't want the next subdivision to be built, right? In their mind, that was open space, and they love it for whatever that is. So now all of a sudden, if they're controlling the narrative and the process and they can kill that development, that's what's happening. And that's especially what's happening with our affordable housing throughout the entire Maricopa County, throughout all of the cities and towns.
This NIMBYism idea, like, no, I don't want this here, but it's great to have affordable housing, but not right here, right?
That's right.
Along those lines, let me ask you both quickly about ADUs, right? So much of the conversation about affordable housing and lowering housing costs in urban metro Phoenix has been about cities and then the state kind of allowing for these backyard casitas to be built to certain specs and, you know, with certain permissions. But this has been very controversial as well, with neighborhoods saying, I don't want this to be allowed because I want my neighborhood to stay the way it is. David, do you think ADUs will make a dent in affordable housing in Phoenix?
I don't think there's any one solution to solving the housing crisis, but having many small solutions is the only way we're going to go through there. And the power of granny flats, casitas, is that you as a homeowner can benefit from providing housing. You can build wealth because this is how America was originally built. This is traditional American community building, is being able to benefit from what you can build and be able to stay in the community with people you know. And so casitas, granny flats, duplexes, fourplexes in our communities, that's how we used to build America. And just since the 1930s, we've decided that we didn't want to do that anymore. And that was a weird experiment. And it's time to go back to traditional American values.
That's interesting. Tom, what's your take on this in terms of these backyard casitas and sort of the pushback that many neighborhoods have had on this?
Well, first, let me just say, I love ADUs. I love casitas, but it's not for everybody. And it doesn't have to be. And I agree with David 100%. We need all sorts of tools in that tool chest. We need options. ADUs may be an option, but it is not going to solve our housing problem at all. It's like the frosting on the cupcake. There just isn't enough there.
Yeah.
There can't possibly be enough there to actually make a dent in how much housing we need.
So let's transition. I want to talk to you both about some of the more kind of quality of life issues that kind of intersect with housing, access to public transportation, the idea that, you know, the buzzword of walkability. There's been a lot of attempts, I think, to do this in Metro Phoenix in various parts, whether it's downtown Gilbert or downtown Chandler or downtown Phoenix, and in other parts, other pockets, right? The expansion of light rail, which has been controversial but is coming. I mean, it's still happening. I wonder what your take on that is in terms of what's happened in the last year or so, David. Like, do you think we're getting to a place where we are doing some of those things that you've been advocating for a long time?
I think we're getting to a point where we can start talking about that in earnest. I don't know how much we've changed. I mean, I think back to John Talton and what he was talking about in the 90s and the 80s. And if we're talking about building traditional American communities where you can have time to spend with your family, you can have time to spend with your friends, and you're not stuck in a car, you're not spending all of your time outside of work, not being home or not being part of the community, it has to come down to building communities like we used to. The number one killer of Americans and Arizonans is heart disease. And why is that? Is it just because we're sitting down a lot? Why are we sitting down so much? It's because we drive around in these luxury living rooms that are just couches. You know, so I think that it's important that we as neighbors talk to other neighbors and elect our local legislators and our city council people to think about, how do we build communities that we want to live in, that we want to grow old in, that we want our kids to buy in? Can your kids purchase in your neighborhood? Can they raise a family? Are those options even here? Where are our kids going? And where are our seniors going? I mean, that's the other thing, is that Arizona's population is aging rapidly. It's the population over 65 has grown by 41% since 2010. Individuals over 65 are the fastest growing population of people who are moving to Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
If we think about that, and we think about people who live here already who are on fixed income, how do they continue to live in their homes? And how do they get support from their neighbors and support from the community? I was talking to Tammy Bohannon from All Thrive 365 recently, and they get thousands of calls a month. And the number one reason they get from across Arizona, number one purpose for those calls is about housing. It's about concerns about eviction. Do I need to pay for food, medication, or rent to be able to – what's going to make me survive this next month? And if we're asking that of our seniors, and our community is getting older as well, how are we going to handle all of that in the next 10 years?
That's an interesting forward-looking thought there. Tom, do you have thoughts on that? Have you seen interesting ideas on that front?
I think I'm going to take – your question and go to the other side of the spectrum of the housing need,
okay.
of the housing needs, and instead talk a little bit more about the homeless and those venturing into just trying to get off the streets. And something that is happening all across the country and in Arizona, and Arizona was at the forefront, I might add, is the concept of healthcare and housing. Healthcare is housing. Mm-hmm. And that is growing to the point where, given the changes at HUD, given the changes with the lack of funding, as we move forward at the state level or local level, I think I firmly believe, and I could give you anecdotal examples, but we're going to start seeing healthcare companies venture more and more, tiptoeing at first, but venture more and more into being housing providers, because it is the healthcare companies who have the revenue, the income, in order to reinvest into the housing side, and their insureds who may be coming from the street. Seriously mentally ill, chronically mentally ill, that sort of thing. There, it's almost impossible to find housing for that demographic. And the healthcare companies know it. They know they have a need to fill, and they know they have these resources that they could actually reinvest and become those housing providers. I think we're going to see some consolidation in those two industries over the next few years.
Okay. Two ends of the spectrum to end on there. That is Tom Simplot, former Phoenix City Councilman, former director of the Arizona Department of Housing, joined by David Crummy, a community advocate on the advisory board for Arches, joining us. Tom, David, thank you both so much for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Lauren.
Thank you so much.
And now we continue our year-end memories of Arizonans who passed away in 2025. It's been almost 25 years since Marilyn Zeitlin left her position as director of Arizona State University's Art Museum, but many in the creative community still remember her 15-year stint there as the high point of the museum's career. John Spiak joined Zeitlin's staff 2 years into her tenure. Today, he's director and chief curator of Cal State Fullerton's Grand Central Art Center. It wouldn't have happened without one of his earliest mentors, Spiak recalls.
From the moment I met Marilyn, I knew the ASU Art Museum was where I needed to be. And I don't think I fully had all the skill sets, but what she saw in me was somebody that was out in the community and believed in that process. As well, I think she was interested that my degrees were not in the arts. They were in sociology and anthropology. And so for her and her process and the way she worked, it seemed like a good match. At that time, Marilyn was deep into working on the project about El Salvador's Civil War. She was working on a show that ended up being called Art Under Duress, El Salvador 1980 to Present. And I would hear stories. She would come back from these adventures and she would talk about crossing the border into El Salvador as the Civil War was taking place and meeting with individuals that were being impacted by the atrocities occurring in that country at that time. But as well, meeting with the artists that were documenting those atrocities. And I mean, the stories were insane. She would talk about there was a filmmaker named John Ewing, and they would go in a pickup truck, turn off the lights, and cross, you know, through these jungles and across these mountains. And at that same time, she was, you know, just nominated to be or just selected to be the U.S. commissioner for the U.S. pavilion at the Venice Biennale. We were also, you know, smallest institution ever to do it, the first west of the Mississippi and only the second educational institution ever to represent the U.S. And, you know, this little museum in Arizona at the time, kind of taking that risk and raising those funds and making that happen. You know, it's because everyone believed in Marilyn and Marilyn's vision. And everyone got behind it because she was that kind of a force. There's a safe way to run a museum and there is a progressive way to run a museum. And Marilyn definitely ran the ASU Art Museum in a progressive, all out kind of manner. The safe way to do it is, you know, take touring shows, show your permanent collection, do work that doesn't challenge conceptual thought. Marilyn pushed those boundaries and constantly brought exhibitions, curated exhibitions, allowed us to create exhibitions that created contemporary dialogue and push the dialogue forward as well. Marilyn, she was fearless. She had a way of not caring how she was going to be perceived as long as she knew what she was doing was the right thing, that the story that needed to be told, no matter how much it was going to hit her, doing the right thing was always important to her.
That was John Spiak remembering Marilyn Zeitlin, who was 84. You can find more remembrance of Arizonans who passed away in 2025 at KJZZ.org.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Tuesday Marl can't imagine a better Hanukkah miracle than a certain salad from a local grocery store. She explains in our latest Eating Christmas essay.
Growing up shopping with my mother, I learned our family's store loyalty stretches about as far as a good coupon. But certain stores were meant for certain things. Target, paper products, cleaning supplies, back-to-school items, clothes. Fry's Food, your go-to staples, microwavable meals, breads, cereals, chips. AJ's Fine Foods, exclusively for meat and fish. Usually picked up by my father on the way home. And we stayed in our lane. A little too fancy for Walmart, a little too cheap for Whole Foods. Over the years, I added to that list with Sprouts. Good old Sprouts. It became my reliable grab-and-go quick meal choice. And working in a newsroom means a lot of grab-and-go. And this is where Sprouts Better Beet Salad enters. I know, people have opinions about beets, but I love them. According to the label, the Sprouts Better Beet Salad contains sweet roasted beets, paired with smooth goat cheese, red onions, honey-toasted pecans, and a drizzle of balsamic vinaigrette, creating the perfect balance of savory, sweet, and earthy flavors. A perfect meal, except for the onions. Now, something you should know about me is I'm not someone who ever rocks the boat. I'd rather handpick the onions off my burger than send the dish back to the kitchen. Similarly, at least twice a week, I meticulously pick the 15 to 20 1-centimeter squares of raw onion out of my Better Beet salad. One particular weekday morning, standing in the aisle of Sprouts, dreading the thought of claw machining the onions out of my salad during lunchtime at my desk in the newsroom, I decided to chalk up the courage to ask for what I wanted. I assured myself I had earned at least a minute inkling of brand loyalty with my neighborhood Sprouts by now, and I stepped up to the sandwich bar brandishing my trusty prepackaged salad. "Excuse me, quick question," I said. A sweet woman, 60s, 70s, with bright name tag labeled Dory, turned around. "What can I do for you, sugar?" she said. "So I absolutely love this salad, but..." I froze. I panicked. "But I'm deadly allergic to onions." Thinking to myself, oh my God, what am I saying? I've never been allergic to anything in my life. Why am I lying to this sweet woman? So is it possible to get this salad without onions? In a voice a bit more chipper than I would have been on a Thursday morning, she said, "Oh, we take allergies very seriously here. I'd love to make you a fresh one." "Thank you. I really appreciate it." "Great. Little white lie, nothing to worry about." As she handed me a freshly made salad, she glanced at my other items. "Oh, hun, you can't get this or this in that case." Of course, Dory knew where the onions were. Of course she did. She snatched up my sandwich wrap and one of their signature soups from my basket. "Oh, thank you, saved me." The sweet woman must be wondering how I possibly lived my first 37 years without her. And now I basically have this big label on my forehead, allergic to onions. But what's to worry about? How often could Dory possibly work? The answer, all the time. Dory works every conceivable hour I would ever plan to pass the threshold of that Sprouts. Mornings, she's there. After I get off work, she waves for me several aisles over. 15 minutes before the store is set to close, there's Dory ready to inspect my basket for contraband that would surely leave me dead in my apartment, just inches away from my EpiPen if it wasn't for her. In all honesty, Dory's relentless guarding of my allergy has turned into an oddly comforting ritual. One I never planned, but now cherish, secretly. As Hanukkah gets closer, her dedication is a kind of unexpected gift. Sure, it's absurd, but there's something comforting in how seriously she takes it, like she's personally responsible for keeping me alive. But I'll take it. 8 nights of light, plus one very persistent Sprouts lady who refuses to let me die.
That was Tuesday Marl performing live on stage at Crescent Ballroom. You can find more Eating Christmas essays at kjzz.org.
All right, that'll do it for this edition of the show. We will, of course, be back with you again tomorrow morning with much more. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram. It's where all the cool kids are, Mark. Did you know that?
I have heard that, yes.
We are at KJZZ The Show, and you can sign up for the show's weekly newsletter, Radioheads, at theshow.kjzz.org. For Mark Brody and Sam Dingman, I'm Lauren Gilger. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. The show is produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, and Ayanna Hamilton. The show was created by John Hoban. Our executive producer is Amy Silverman.